Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Paul K. Pack, MD, Medical Director of the Thoracic Oncology Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, to discuss the FDA approval of tepotinib for patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer harboring MET exon 14 skipping alterations. On February 3, 2021, the FDA granted an accelerated approval to tepotinib based on data from the Phase 2 VISION trial, which showed that the MET inhibitor induced an objective response rate of 43% among 69 treatment-naive patients per blinded independent review committee using RECIST version 1.1 criteria. Moreover, the median duration of response with the agent was 10.8 months. Regarding safety, the most frequently reported adverse effects with tepotinib included edema, fatigue, nausea, diarrhea, musculoskeletal pain, and dyspnea. The FDA noted that the agent can also lead to interstitial lung disease, hepatotoxicity, and embryo-fetal toxicity. In our exclusive interview, Pack provided perspective on the FDA approval of tepotinib in MET exon 14 altered metastatic non-small cell lung cancer.
In terms of clinical implications, how do you foresee this impacting the space of lung cancer?
The importance of the approval of tepotinib by the FDA recently can be thought of in a few different ways. I think first, of course, it has to do with our patients. Those patients who have MET exon 14 skipping alterations are a particular subset of patients who have non-small cell lung cancer. This is a subset that tends to be fairly old. The median age of diagnosis for these patients is about 73 to 74 across all series. And as way of contrast, the median age for most of our trials in lung cancer are in the lower 60s, and for some other oncogene-addicted cancers, these are patients in their lower 50s. So a lot of these patients are older. A lot of them are in their 80s. And so they have particular special considerations when it comes to trying to figure out what treatments will be effective, but also what treatments will be well tolerated. And these are patients that generally are not represented in the pivotal upfront trials. And so there's been this need for better treatments for these patients. And so the approval of tepotinib is one step forward in that regard, having a fairly well-tolerated oral agent that's pretty effective in this patient population. That's probably the most important, I think, aspect of the recent approval. I think the second reason why it's important is that it's yet another driver alteration that we've been able to target in lung cancer. And for me, the more that we're able to find for our patients, the more chance that we'll be able to offer some other options for these folks. And as it relates to biomarker testing in this population, the word's getting out pretty well that we should be performing next-gen sequencing as a standard of care for all of our patients at the time of diagnosis. And this helps with that in terms of guideline recommendations for doing this in both lung adenocarcinoma and squamous cell lung cancer patients.
You mentioned that this population is older and that this boom of, targeted therapy has happened. So regarding patients with MET exon 14 skipping mutations, what is sort of the incidence rate of these alterations in the lung cancer space? How frequently are we seeing these?
The incidence of MET exon 14 skipping in non-small cell lung cancers or all comers is about 3 to 4%, depending on the series that you end up looking at. It tends to be more common in patients who have lung adenocarcinomas than in squamous lung cancer patients, though we do find them in squamous lung cancer patients. And importantly, there's a rare histologic subtype of non-small cell lung cancer. These patients have sarcomatoid carcinomas, which are pretty treatment refractory. And we find MET exon 14 skipping alterations in about a quarter to a third of these patients. So it's a rare subpopulation who should definitely be tested for these alterations.
Then regarding the VISION trial that obviously led to the approval, could you discuss just sort of the design of that study and the patient population that was included?
The VISION trial is, I should say, because it's still ongoing for one of the cohorts, a single-arm phase 2 trial of tepotinib in MET-altered lung cancer. I say MET-altered lung cancer because one of the cohorts, which is cohort B, data of which has not yet been presented, focuses on patients who have MET-amplified non-small cell lung cancers, but cohorts A and C target patients who have MET exon 14 skipping. And the approval was based on cohort A. And in this case, these were non-small cell lung cancer patients who had advanced disease, who were treated, all of them, with tepotinib at the dose of 500 milligrams once daily. And it was for the purposes of efficacy. It was an interesting trial insofar as the biomarker inclusion included opportunities to get on both in terms of tissue testing, but also in terms of liquid biopsy testing. And so remains unique in that perspective, validating efficacy for detection of the alteration in ctDNA, which again is unique. And so that was the structure of the study, fairly straightforward, looking really for an efficacy signal. Of course, the results were sufficient for FDA approval.
And going right into those results, could you highlight some of the key findings that were observed in this study?
The overall response rate has held up pretty consistently around the mid 40% range. For the independent review committee, investigator response rates hover at just over about 50%, with a median PFS of about 9 months. So these are durable responses that patients end up having on study. This included outcomes both if we took a look at only patients who had tumor testing that showed the MET exon 14 skipping event, and also patients who just had the liquid biopsy call out for that. So again, verifying that liquid biopsy is suitable for identifying these in patients. The study also took a look at a few other things, including whether or not there was variability in response based on lines of therapy. So if patients were treatment naive or if they had been treated with prior therapy before, the results were consistent, basically, in terms of first-line treatment versus second-line treatment and beyond for response rate and PFS within statistical significance. So again, this is an important take-home message. Like many targeted therapies, whether or not you give it up front or later on, the efficacy seems to be similar. And then finally, one of the unique aspects was because ctDNA testing was built in, we had serial assessment, molecular assessment for determination of resistance and sensitivity. And some of this data was presented in our New England Journal article and has been presented and will be presented as well in other meetings. And that's been valuable also in terms of trying to map out what the next steps are going to be for the development of the field.
I wanted to highlight patients with brain metastases because I know that the trial enrolled a couple of patients with brain metastases. So could you speak a little bit to the utility of tepotinib in this subset of patients?
I think it's most accurate to say that we don't yet quite know prospectively what the efficacy of tepotinib is in brain metastases just because we haven't done that study and because most of the patients who were enrolled onto tepotinib did not have what would be protocol-specified measurable disease or target lesions in the CNS. A fair number of these patients had prior radiotherapy to their brain metastases, for example, and that wasn't built in as a formal criterion. And so we'll have to wait, I think, for more robust data in terms of CNS activity for tepotinib. We have presented preclinical data showing that tepotinib is effective in orthotopic models in mice against MET-driven brain metastases. And we've also presented the general experience of these patients who had brain metastases with tepotinib, and systemically, they have no earlier progression than other patients. We will be presenting later on some more detailed analysis in terms of what that efficacy looks like. But I'd say that generally speaking, I don't think many of us have too much of a concern in terms of what the potential efficacy is going to be based on preclinical modeling and some other data that's been presented with other drugs for efficacy in the CNS, but we're going to have to wait, I think, until we get sort of more robust data to make that final determination.
What about regarding toxicity or safety signals? Was anything observed with this agent that, as it's being implemented in clinical practice, should be on the lookout for?
Tepotinib is well tolerated as an oral therapy, particularly as it relates to, again, that older population where we worry about giving chemotherapy and with some questions still remaining as to whether or not immunotherapy is effective in this particular oncogene-addicted cancer. So overall, it's well tolerated. The side effects that we see tend to be class effect for MET inhibition. So we see this across lots of different drugs that target MET. And probably the most common would be peripheral edema. Most patients will end up getting some degree of peripheral edema. This was about 50 to 60% patients, depending on, again, the series that you look at. Most of these are grade 1 to 2 events. So these are things that don't necessarily impede in quality of life. But again, it's an important adverse event, particularly in our older patients who have limited mobility. Any amount of additional edema in the feet and legs can, you know, still be difficult for them to manage. And so the management of this is going to be important to understand later on. Some additional side effects that we've seen, again, that are class effects, have to do with upper GI side effects. Fatigue, of course, is common with all different treatments. And then some other sort of more unusual side effects in terms of a usually benign increase in creatinine, a decrease in albumin, which can play into the edema that we see, and some modest increase in LFTs also that we see.
And you highlighted that this is an oral regimen. So could you maybe speak to the importance of this being an oral regimen for the elderly population, even, you know, highlighting the fact that we're still in the COVID-19 pandemic? So what is sort of the benefits that a patient could derive from an oral therapy versus maybe having to come in for chemotherapy or immunotherapy infusion?
Oral therapies, I think, are important for a few different reasons. One tends to be psychological, and that has to do, I think, with trying to regain a sense of independence and freedom following the diagnosis of cancer. And oral therapies generally lend themselves to that because you're not tied to the, you know, to the cancer institute that you got to end up going to every couple of weeks or every few weeks. And so there's a lot more flexibility in terms of assessments and obtaining the drug. And we saw the benefits of that, of course, during COVID, as you had mentioned, in terms of that great degree of freedom we had for telehealth assessments for patients who could just stay at home, get local blood, you know, sent over to us, and we could just see them on video how well they're doing, and, you know, follow up with them once every few months, you know, for example, while they remain safe, you know, from outside exposure. That's one of the big ones, of course, and that's multiple components to the oral therapies. I think the other, at least in lung cancer, is that by and large, the oral therapies that we've developed that are targeted tend to be pretty well tolerated. And again, that has been an important boon in the treatment landscape, particularly, as you mentioned, for our elderly patients.
Speaking to the tolerability of this, do you foresee this being an option for potential combination strategies moving forward? Or what is sort of the future of this agent in terms of broadening its efficacy, I suppose?
That, of course, is an excellent question, and things that we're already beginning to think about exactly how to increase the efficacy and also potentially get at some of the side effects with MET inhibition. And so these are things that I'm already beginning to think of, and many others, in terms of next steps. And this relates both in terms of trying to figure out why it is that patients end up developing resistance to this. And still, we're in the early stages of figuring this out. The data that we've presented and other colleagues, Mark Awad's group, for example, at Dana-Farber, has shown nicely what some of these resistance profiles are, depending on the kind of MET inhibitor that's used. So we're beginning to understand that, although the early data suggests that there's not going to be kind of a silver bullet that works for most patients in terms of overcoming resistance. And so a lot of the focus now for me, at least personally, is trying to figure out upfront, how do we extend the efficacy of these with combinatorial therapies? And so the logical things that the field generally looks at is in combination with existing treatments already. So for example, combinations with chemotherapy, you know, drugs like that, combinations with other targeted therapies that might be of interest. There's development, for example, ongoing with MET antibodies, which we initially had looked at now a decade ago, but which failed to generate an efficacy signal in randomized phase 3 data. But we're beginning to look at that now as it relates to targeting exon 14 skipping. And so there are a few different, I think, efforts that are ongoing to try to figure out what the next steps are going to be therapeutically.
Is there anything else from either the VISION trial or with tepotinib that we didn't touch on that you'd like to mention as being particularly important?
I think for the VISION trial, there was that cohort B, patients who did not have MET exon 14 skipping alterations, but who had high level MET amplification. We've not yet reported those data, but we'll be reporting those data in the future, naturally, because the, you know, cohort B is right now closed. And so that's, I think, something to take a look at for the future, I think, for a couple of different reasons. One, again, by itself, MET amplified lung cancers we do see, and so it's important to try to find additional therapies for these patients. And the other is because MET amplification does happen as a resistance mechanism for other oncogene addicted cancers, and so getting additional data for MET inhibition just generally is going to be helpful in terms of trying to figure out how to treat additional patients in different molecular contexts.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave on Air.